called a Mechanism. It's a Mises Academy course. And tonight we move on to something that we've been laying the basis for the whole time, this crucial year of 1917, and the two great sea changes that took place in the same year made it a really different kind of war, and that is the American entry into the war and the two Russian revolutions. You know, one way of thinking about this is that the deeper forces do begin to break through here. This is the thought that we had talked about earlier. A great historian named René Albrecht Carrier made this point in his really good book, The Meaning of the First World War. And it's 1917 where we see societies begin really to come unglued, so that the state has taken so much from them, including the lives of people, that you just have these great sort of tectonic changes in the countries involved, in the war itself, and in the way things that work. Meanwhile, the states, as you know, were trying to play like everything's fine. I thought this was a nice little piece of irony to have this German poster up there. It's about the most fatuous thing I've ever seen in my life, and it's in a set of postcards that a friend of mine found at a antique shop from somebody's attic somewhere here in Texas not long ago. And at the top it says, in memory of the war years, year 1916. And then there's a little poem on the bottom, wenn wir fest zusammenhalten, treu nach Bethmann-Hollwegs Lehren, dann wird sich der Hungerteufel bald zu allen Teufeln scheren. If we hold together and hold on tight to Bethmann-Hollweg's teachings, that's the chancellor, right? Bethmann-Hollweg's teachings, then certainly the devil of hunger will soon be thrown off with all the other devils. Pretty fatuous. I mean, what's about to happen is a real calamity for the 20th century. So I like Danny Sanchez's code word for our course. And here comes the real calamity. After the year 1916, the combatant states, and we will study this later, we'll get back to the battlefronts in later classes, but the attacks get even greater. I mean, we talked about these huge offensives in 1916 with the Somme and Verdun and so forth. But the Allies attack, the Central Powers attack. There's even more blood spilled, even more slaughter. For example, the Nivelle offensive in France involved just a new wave of unprotected, unprepared frontal assaults against the Germans, who were eminently qualified to shoot all those French soldiers down in no man's land. And the effect of it was that a large percentage of the French army mutinied in the spring of 1917. So there were changes in many ways and in many countries. In Austria-Hungary, in the Ottoman Empire. But above all, the war changed shape as two things happened, and that is, of course, the American intervention and the Russian Revolution. So let's talk about Russia first, and see what we can do with this in a short span, because we could, of course, spend a whole hour and a half talking about Russia falling apart and the revolutions and how that shaped up. But within an 8-week course, we just don't have that much time to spend on each specific. But we can get to it, of course, in the question and answer. There are many problems for Russia and the war. In the war, as we've already seen, I just remind you of the Rasputin problem, the problem of this bizarre monk who got to be attached to the royal house because he could somehow staunch the flow of blood internally and externally of the young Tsarevich, who had a blood disease of some kind, probably hemophilia. And Rasputin was a disreputable in many ways, a kind of gross, grotesque, nasty, and just discredited the royal house. He was assassinated in December 1916 by some Russian nobleman, but that didn't make all that much difference. At that point, it was very late in the game. In September 1915, Nicholas II had appointed himself commander-in-chief. And this was a very essential problem in the Russian war effort, in that the monarchy still had a lot of life, and in wartime the monarchs in Russia had over the last 300-400 years played very essential roles in as real heads of state, as rallying the people, as being symbols of something riding abstractly over the war effort. And when Nicholas II put himself in charge as commander in chief, then that meant that when, for example, the Brusilov forces were thrown back, it was really not Brusilov's fault, it was the Tsar's fault, and so forth and so on. The great retreat, even before that, from Poland. He was discredited. I generally tell my students in the college classes, and I can tell you this as well, if you ever decide to, if you ever find yourself in the position of being the monarch of a country during wartime, don't make yourself commander-in-chief. It's just a bad idea, and I'll stick with it. The in 1917, the Russians were hard up for the troops to replace the men killed. I mean, by January 1917, they called up 15 million people from the countryside who had not, over and above the other draft and conscription troops. So things fall apart at home. They really do, and people get out in the streets. They're hungry in the cities. They're depressed and ravaged in the countryside, and the country really falls apart. Now, I'm going to go through this next bit rather fast, and you can see the Wikipedia expanded Bolshevik Revolution chronology. And to some in the class, I apologize, because you're seeing this slide for the second time if you took the totalitarians course, because this is that same, it's the same slide. But I think it's a good slide, and it works for both courses, and it gets us through all this. Yes, it is true. I have plagiarized myself. So anyway, the here's how it goes. People got out in the streets in a supplicant way. The Tsar reacted in a brutal way, shot people down. He was perfectly accustomed to people protesting in the streets from the 1905 revolution, and he mishandled it then too. So there was a popular revolution, and almost seemingly without effort, the Tsar was overthrown, and the Tsar's family was packed off to the countryside, and the people who came to power were the people who had been in the opposition for all those years, namely the Cadet Party, the Constitutional Party, and a number of other smaller parties, some kind of moderately conservative, and then some who were classical liberal types, and then some who were more national liberal types. But they also expanded out to the peripheries to bring in as many of the sort of at least reliable left parties as they could to put in this provisional government. And they headed it with a liberal prince, Prince Lvov. So what they did was to do what the constitutional party had wanted to do the whole time, that is to make a real constitution, which they proceeded to start putting it together. But they immediately declared basically freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, etc., all the, you know, those liberal things in that sense. So when they opened, but on the other hand, they stayed in the war. The Allies were, the other Entente members were scared to death that the Russians would drop out. And if you just imagine for a moment the sort of balance of the Western Front and the other fronts in the sense that we talked about last week, where everybody's straining every nerve, and the front just moves a little bit. And this is on all the, this is on the high seas and every place. So what if suddenly Russia drops out, and that releases all those Austrians to smash Italy, and it releases all those Germans to hit the Western Front? Then it's a disaster. But those provisional government guys reassure the West, we are not getting out of the war. This is going to be a better place. We're going to mobilize for war. We're going to have freedom of speech, and we're really going to go after it. But since they open things up to freedom of speech and freedom of the press, then what happens is that all the revolutionaries who have been exiled out of the country are rushed back. So, for example, Trotsky, who was having a pretty good time in the Lower East Side in New York, arrived back in Russia. Lenin, who was in Zurich, arrived back in Russia. They arrive in a very particular way, those two, Lenin and Trotsky. Both were financed by sources from without. Trotsky in New York was financed by certain New York bankers who had roots in Russia, or at least who hated the Tsar because of his treatment of Jews, and they helped Trotsky get back to Russia. And then the German General Staff, combined with the German Foreign Office, hatched out a plan almost immediately to finance Lenin, who was in Zurich, to get through Germany into Russia and to do his thing. I mean, in the German case, they reasoned that if Lenin has said that he wants to get out of the war, then let's just put him there and let him take over. So they gave him money, millions of dollars worth of money. Trotsky got money too. Both of these were sent back. Lenin traveled back with a pack of revolutionaries on the famous sealed train through Germany. It actually was just boarded up. I mean, the Germans didn't want him to stop and revolutionize Germany. So Lenin got back very quickly. Trotsky came on a liner very quickly, and both brought revolutionaries, both brought money, and started a concerted propaganda effort. Now, all these parties came back, especially the Russianist leftists, the social revolutionaries. They came back to the ones who had been in exile and in hiding and whatnot, and the other parties too. And so Russia became a big, the cities became big debating places, they were listening to all kinds of ideas, even as the war is still going on. So this is an extremely confusing situation. As the government is making a constitution, people in Russia have never had freedom of speech before at this point. They've never had freedom of the press before. They've never had a real constitution. By the summer of 1917, and I'm oversimplifying here just a bit, but the Bolsheviks set up a call for land, peace, and bread. That's the slogan, and they hammer on it mercilessly. That gives something to everybody, to the peasants on the countryside who are a huge audience. The country at this point is still 60%, 70% peasant. They want land. To the soldiers returning and the soldiers' families, the soldiers who are returning wounded and the families of the soldiers on the front, they get peace. And then for folks in the city, they promise bread. So they call for this almost illogical fantasy program: land, peace, and bread. That's all we want. But it's great propaganda. It sells. In the summer of 1917, after another offensive, the army on the front disintegrates, and so soldiers just begin to stream back to Russia. And meanwhile, a radical, almost anarchist branch of Russian leftism, the Council movement, the Soviet movement, not the Bolsheviks, but the Soviet movement, begins to gain power because they set up councils in every factory, in every military unit, in every section of the city, in every precinct. And so this council movement is supposed to be government from the bottom up, and they gain increasing power. They send representatives to the higher councils, and there is a supreme council that's supposed to take care of things. But that's what the word Soviet means. It means council. So they're doing their own sort of left-oriented thing. The Bolsheviks are promoting land, peace, and bread. The government moves the coalition from the center to the left. And eventually, mostly in the socialist direction, and eventually one of the leftists, one of the socialists on the cabinet, Lvov leaves and is taken over by Alexander Kerensky. And so it's the provisional government is under the watch of Kerensky, the socialist, when the Bolsheviks seize power in October. It's actually November, but they were still on the old Julian calendar. So they seize power, declare war communism. Lenin takes over as a member of the Council's people, Council of People's Commissars. And the Council of People's Commissars, who are all Bolshevik, pretends to be a part of the Soviet movement. They're really not at all. But in fact, they declare that the new name of the country is the Soviet Union, just as a kind of propaganda plea. So that's a lot in just a couple of minutes and for one slide, but we get the Bolsheviks in power that way. Here's the Central Committee of the Communist Party in 1917, and they're a checkered lot. They come from many parts of the empire. A very high number of the council consists of Russian Jews. A high number consists of people from the peripheries of Russia in several different ways, not just the Pale of Settlement where the Jews live mostly. So it's a government of outsiders, and you see Stalin there in the top row, the fourth from the left, and he's certainly an outsider, this Georgian person. But these are the characters who have come to power to try to run Russia. A civil war breaks out almost immediately as the background to what happens next, and that is that the Bolsheviks, having not ever imagined they would gain power at such an early date, don't quite know how to work things. But Lenin, in the Council of People's Commissars, and I think this is very important, Lenin says, we don't have to worry about how to take total control of the economy because the Germans have already done it. You see, the year before, Ludendorff and Hindenburg had come to power in the West, and Ludendorff had been the architect of this Hindenburg program, which, in fact, as you may remember from last week, it helped that the Germans had already redefined property in many ways and redefined all kinds of old-fashioned liberal nostrums to create the kind of new total warfare. And so so Lenin said they've already done it. Ludendorff and Hindenburg have created a military dictatorship in Germany. They, when they need people to work, they just go out and haul people in, especially in occupied areas. They, in their occupation of the areas behind the front, on the Russian front, they simply carried out forced labor. They shot people when they wanted to. If people didn't work for them, they got rid of them. Everybody had to have papers to move so much as half a mile down a road, and so forth and so on. So these total controls. And so Lenin says, we just take that and copy it. So essentially what the Bolsheviks set up was, and here I have the whole SEAL train episode here. Lenin sets up a kind of imitation of the German dictatorship and made a reference to it in the Council of People's Commissars in November 1917. So that's their model, And so that's what that's where war communism comes from. It's an adaptation of the Hindenburg program designed by Ludendorff for Russian conditions. It's total war. It's a total war economy. It's the planned economy. It's all of it. All these things that we hear from Mises, and this is one thing that we talked about extensively in that totalitarian course. That's really important here, right in the center of World War One, to realize that in Mises' historical works and his works analyzing totalitarianism and bureaucracy and nationalism, he goes right to the heart of these and thinking about what had happened in Germany as well as the Soviet Union. In other words, there's this similarity. There's this also communication, this back and forth element. And this happens right in the interior of the war. And of course, it's a calamity, as Mises saw and realized almost immediately. It's a calamity he foresaw it then, and he was right. It's a calamity for the 20th century. It's a calamity for the 21st century. It's such a disaster that this total war economy kicked in Germany, in Russia, and elements of it in all the countries at war. It's really a deeper force breaking through in the most horrible way. And then on top of that, a second disaster. We set up in seemingly a perpetual totalitarian government in the Soviet Union, in Russia, existed in its full form until 1989-90 and 91, and in its lesser forms, in its tail ends, in many ways up to the present. So again, there's this twin disaster that occurs because of this war. It's hard to overemphasize calamitous nature of all that. Well, let's take on another calamity then. I mean, it's a night for calamities. The whole war is. You just can't think of much good that comes out of this war, and the only things that do come from individuals thinking, working, attempting to overcome this overwhelming kind of total war that encounters them. So, as we look into the eyes of Woodrow Wilson, let's think of American entry into World War I. The American Declaration was April 6th. I mean, I'll tell the ending right now. It's April 6th, but there's some history behind this that we have to mention. For one thing, all the standard high school textbooks will tell you that America was an isolationist country before World War One, and before, or perhaps up into 1898. It's certainly true that George Washington, in his farewell address in 1796, made these wonderful comments about how America should be a friend to everybody, but tied up to none. That the United States should be a country that trades with people. That there should be these even, fair exchanges. And not the exchanges of invasions and war and whatnot, and that had been, to some extent, the norm in American history. Although sometimes, I mean, we have enough variations from that they're very important to talk about: the Mexican War, the war between the states, and so forth. But as we get to the 1890s, when the opponents of this traditional norm became stronger and stronger, and began to brand the older, the older view as isolationist, then let's ask at this time in the 1890s, what was so isolated about this? The United States had an international population that came from just about every continent, every populated continent. There were cities with dozens and dozens of nationalities. There was the most vast migration in the history of the world was in progress, and much of that migration was coming to the United States, people bringing their own languages, their own foods, their own entertainment, and so forth, and bringing many of those, you know, all those things to the United States to be hurled against each other and hooked together and with this sort of cultural clash that that's been a continual aspect of American history since then. So we have maybe the most international population of any country on the face of the earth in the 1890s. We have international trade. The United States surpasses everybody in international trade in this decade, and it becomes the merchant center of the whole world. And so it's dealing with countries all across the globe in all kinds of ways. Its shipping industry is huge. It's shipping goods back and forth from one place to the other. And with all this trade and so forth, that goes international cultural connections. So that, the culture of the Far East comes to America, even as American merchant ships trade in the Far East and other places. So I just have to ask, on the heels of this description, I think most folks would agree with all of this, what was so isolated about all that? In other words, how could you possibly describe this as isolation from anything? If anything, the lack of political alliances and political connections actually made it a broader spectrum, because it was this kind of spontaneous order that went in all kinds of directions and then came back to work itself out at home. So those people who invented the term isolation for this situation had to be thinking about some other program. They had to have something in the background that they wanted instead. They wanted these political alliances for some particular reason. And then, of course, in 1898 comes this new regime. Somebody asked the good question last week, would you put the United States in the category of the empires? And before 1898, I don't think I would, but after 1898, I think I have to, because the United States invaded foreign countries in that year at the juncture of the Spanish-American War, took over territory in Puerto Rico, the Philippines. I began to take more islands in the Pacific. It really set up a foreign empire, exactly in the same way that the European powers had done. Then the open door in China and American settlements in China, and American participation in the European-style international loans to China, and so forth and so on. So there was this international political regime in the form of empire that appeared after 1898. I think we should come now. I mean, into this milieu comes then Woodrow Wilson, who's the star of our show at this point. And somebody we have to think about for the next little while. I mean, everybody's got an opinion about Woodrow Wilson, and I'm sure you've all done a lot of reading, and the things I'm about to say will no doubt be no news to any of you. But we've got to deal with him some way, so let me just say a few words about him. Woodrow Wilson was born in Stanton, Virginia, the son of a Presbyterian minister, and Very early on, told his family at the dinner table that he, when he grew up, would be in a lofty position. And I'm quoting there. He ended up being a very, very bright student. Went to Johns Hopkins for his graduate school, taught at Princeton, and soon he really chafed at the role of political science professor. His specialty, by the way, was internal administration, and he knew not much about foreign affairs, not much about legislative affairs. He was mostly a kind of expert on bureaucracies. In the classroom, I mean, but he was an excellent classroom lecturer. We have many witnesses and a lot of people who took notes on his classes and so forth. He was very interested in the increasingly popular waves of positivism, that is Comteism, Compteism, that is to say the top-down rule of society that Auguste Comte suggested. You will recall that Comte, in the middle of the 19th century, a contemporary of Marx, and also a socialist, but in this case a sort of pragmatic socialist, in that he said, well, people are just so, we're not trying to free them from anything, they're just like cattle. I mean, you can't get representatives from cattle and then debate on various laws. That's just ridiculous. So what you need is sort of a philosopher king situation. Comtean society and the society also envisioned by his mentor Saint-Simon before him. These societies were technocratic in that great thinkers or great experts would be the heads of society. And Wilson thought of himself as a political scientist. I mean, we know today they're the high priests of the state, right? While historians at least have a little bit of ethics left in them. And that's a joke. Some of my best friends are political scientists, to coin a phrase. But Wilson was a political scientist and had that will to power, you might say, and ended up as president of Princeton University. So he didn't end up, unfortunately, but he was there. By the way, he was a real hypochondriac. Wilson spent much of his 20s and 30s telling everybody around him how soon he would be dying and how his ailments, undisclosed ailments, would very soon lay him low, but they didn't. So Wilson becomes president of Princeton, gets in a couple of famous disputes. He's a kind of a guy. He's had it's a very interesting work done in terms of psychobiography, in other words, using the tools of psychological analysis to kind of figure him out. And he's a fascinating subject. A man and a woman named George, a couple named, whose last name is George, Alexandra and Julia George, wrote a famous psychobiography of Wilson back in the late 50s, early 60s. And it is a wonderful, fascinating read. And it's quite clear to them that he had some problems at various times in his life, and for whatever reason, he had this kind of will to power. But when he would get into power, I mean, he actually was the president of Princeton, but they were about to build a new graduate school, and he wanted it in one place, and the faculty wanted it in another place, and the dean of the faculty opposed him, and Wilson just hated him, vilified him, loathed him, fought back. In a vicious way, and this is that kind of pattern with him. Now, I mean, since he's the star of our show, we do need to spend some time on him because we have to decide what it all means at the end of it. So, partway through all this process, he's befriended by a gentleman from Houston, Texas, an honorary colonel named, that we always call Colonel House. That's Edward Mandel House. And I think, you know, he's the one on the left there. House was a person who whose father got involved with banking. He originally had ranch land in South Texas, and the family bought nice, they had their ranch out in the countryside, and they bought their nice home for the wealthy in Houston somewhere. And they had some oil, they had some cattle. This is a period in which, right at the turn of the century, many Texas cattle dynasties shifted into oil, and many of them lost their property in sharp dealing by the oil prospectors and the oil companies that came in, and these well-connected people who were actually brokers for the Rockefeller companies and so forth. But the Houses managed to hang on to a lot of their wealth, at least enough to get into banking as well. So the young House was a Colonel House, born about 1860, and he married and had a business, was himself a little bit sickly, but by the time he got in his 30s, he realized that he had a real knack for managing from behind the scenes, he didn't want power as such, or at least he didn't want to be the front man for power. He wanted to be a kind of man behind the throne. The real, the Germans call that der Drahtzieher, because the Draht is the wire that leads down from your little control thing to the puppets. And so the wire puller is the person who's controlling the puppets, but really, of course, doing all the movement. So he wanted to be the Drahtzieher in many ways, and he got in a tremendous position to do this in Texas politics. It was then a Democratic state before we had the colors, and only Democratic, and he controlled a substantial part of the Democratic Party, plenty to swing into power four different governors who were a part of his machine, and we can only call that a machine. But in the course of this, even as he was controlling Texas politics, he moved to New York in 1902 in his early 40s and began to cultivate a much bigger machine, looking for somebody that he could make his president. He already had elected a senator of his own from Texas, so he was really a power broker and connected with the Morgan people. Now, to say something else about, and I have to say it here, about the progressives, and I want to remind you of this, we've been over it briefly, but whereas we tend to think of the progressives as reformers, as people who didn't want child labor to continue, to horrible conditions in meatpacking, break up the big financial dynasties and the corporations and things like this, but of course at the higher levels of studying this, there was, everybody always knew that almost none of that was really the main game. And today, even in mainstream historical studies, we all know that essentially the progressives were a party that movement that was involved in promoting the schemes of a number of bankers, the Morgan group in particular, and some related groups, some allied groups. So partly they're promoting these banking schemes, but all of these folks are positivists in the Comtean sense, and therefore they sprinkle over all this the veneer of wanting to reform, of ruling from above, of the wise men at the top saying what happens to the cattle-like people down below. And House, no less than any other of these people, wanted to be in this kind of game. quite explicitly as a political power behind careers and thrones and whatnot. And so he found out about Woodrow Wilson. He observed him. Wilson became governor of New Jersey, and about this time, then House latched onto him, and began to make his preparations to support him as president. In fact, the two became so close that they began to talk in almost creepy ways about their being alter egos to each other, and only can confide the closest thoughts to each other. And I don't think they explicitly used the term BFF, but I mean it was something along those lines. So Wilson and House and Wilson. House gets him elected president in 1912, Wilson comes to power. Now, just a little bit. Oh, I don't want to go to the Bryce report yet. I'll stay here. Let me go to the Bryce report. I think that's what I actually had intended. So let me just wind this up. Let me leave Wilson and House, and we'll leave them sitting in a, I don't know, chatting on the back porch of a mansion somewhere while we talk about the war. So meantime, Wilson's elected in 1912, dealing with reforms, right, of the progressive kind, not paying a whole lot of attention to foreign policy, except that he does invade four different countries by the time we get to 1916, all Latin American. However, we'll leave them for the moment and talk of the war starts. It's 1914. The Germans invade Belgium. They committed awful things. The Germans had massacres in southern Africa in 1907-1908, the German military had developed a doctrine based on these horrific activities, this kind of tough love. You know, you don't let any guerrilla activity happen. The first sign of it, you just massacre people all around. So they had this kind of doctrine that they called fearsomeness, Fürchtigkeit. And that was a big thing with German officers, telling their troops, you can't show any quarter. If a civilian takes a pot shot at you, then we go into that town and get 20 people and just shoot them down so that nobody else takes a pot shot. Reprisal shootings, burning buildings, just horrible, just really behaving terribly. So the Germans did this. And if you want to read about this, there's a friend of mine, Jeff Lipkis, and I don't think I put this into the slides, Lipkes, who used to come to the Austrian Scholars conferences. That's how I met him probably 15 years ago, and I've known him in some other connections. But he's written a book about this, and he and a couple of others make this connection between Africa and these brutalities of this way of operating in Germany. So there were these German atrocities. Okay, I say atrocities. Somehow the library in Leuven and this was a terrible tragedy, and so forth and so on. So there are these atrocities. But as I've already said when we started this, at the beginning, or maybe the second session, the atrocities were these things, these reprisal shootings and these brutal things, just terrible. But what the British did was to take the case of Belgium, and of course there were many Britain was flooded with Belgian refugees. Do you know who the most famous Belgian refugee was? You know, there were all these Belgians who were refugees and were brought over to Britain, given nice places to live. They went to nice schools. They had a great war. There is a famous one. The only problem is he's fictional. Poirot is a Belgian refugee. So So the most famous one of these people is actually a fictional character. But thanks, Kim. You've got Jeff's book there. Yeah, I think it's an important book. And what we're saying here is that the Germans were brutal. Jeff really wants to believe in some of the other kinds of almost pornographic atrocities, and I wouldn't go with him there, but he's done an awful lot of work on it. It's just that you can tell from his language he didn't quite have the goods at that point. But here's what they did was to write a report with this just almost pornographic type violence. I mean, rapes and mutilations and people priests nailed up to houses and nuns raped and nailed up and little children with their hands cut off and just terrible thing, just inconceivable things. And these kinds of things then were put into a report by British intelligence, and they got the permission of a prominent jurist, Lord Bryce, also a kind of a member of the Liberal Party. He was back in the old days, was a Gladstonian liberal, I believe, and he thought he was doing a good thing to put his name on this report, and so he put his name on it, and that was the Bryce report issued in May 12th, in 1915. The Germans were brutal in Belgium, and they were brutal in France too. You can see this. There are German memoirs of the war, and where they just clearly say, "Well, we stopped at this farmhouse, and the lady was so nice; she cooked for us and everything." This is in the first days of the war, and the officer says, "I went outside and saw her washing hung up, and it looked like there was a code there, but I think we figured out it really wasn't a code. I'm glad I didn't have to shoot her." So I mean, he was quite ready to do so, and that's how they were being trained. So I'll make another couple of points about this. I've already talked just a bit about it, but the Germans were brutal in Belgium, and the Russians were brutal on the Eastern Front. I mean, the Russians invaded East Prussia, killed about 1,200 people. They hauled off an enormous number of East Prussians. It was something like 10,000, 13,000 East Prussians as hostages, and only about 6,000 or 7,000 of those ever came back. So it's whether those hostages died in Russia in labor camps or they lived or maybe took up a new life in Russia, they were gone. So I'm going to say it's about the same number in a very short occupation of East Prussia. Remember, that's not very long. About the same area. And they destroyed many more towns, burned and shelled many more towns. So this is the way armies operated at that juncture, especially the big imperialistic armies. Somebody mentioned in the comments a minute ago that the Belgians themselves had committed horrors in the Congo. That is, and there's absolutely no doubt about that. The Russians in their rear areas deported, they ethnically cleansed Jews and ethnic Germans, sent them out to die in midwinter in Central Asia, just dumped them in the middle of nowhere, probably. Something over 800,000 or a million Jews were killed. A lot of Germans, ethnic Germans in Russia. The Ottoman regime under the pressure of war and also built up to this cruelty, and with their own tradition of cruelty too, killed a lot of Armenians behind the lines, as you know very well. So there was a lot of brutality. The Germans didn't have any corner on that market. But to make it seem like they did, the British wrote this way over the top report. You can read it easily. It's in the World War I document archive. It's in several places online now. But one of the important issues is, and this is something that Trevor Wilson commented on in a really great article from 1979 in the Journal of Contemporary History. And that is that there's this sense, there's this real sexual sense in here. There's a lot of the violence is just so, it's like something out of the Marquis de Sade, something like old-timey sadistic effete gentleman's porn, you know? And thought through, Wilson thinks, and aimed at an American audience, simply because the British conceived of the Americans as being much more sort of respectful of women, you know, in all these studies we have now, the Old West, where they say, yeah, it was a Wild West, but the incidence of rape was extremely low compared to modern times and compared to other places and that type of thing. And so, and the Americans had some kind of notion of women being on a pedestal and protected or something like that. And so the British saw that and they said, "Ha! This will get them. These kind of rape stories and mutilation stories, especially of women." And then the posters that come that are based on this notion. In other words, you have to read the Bryce Report to know about the posters with the mother holding her child and the evil rapists violating Belgium. Is she Belgium or is she an individual mother? Could be either, could be both. You see what I'm saying. So oh, thank you. There's a Bryce Report there. Excellent. This comes out, and it's aimed at America. And I just make this, point. I've already talked about it in connection with England, but I make it in connection now with the United States. And you'll see how it mixes together with a number of other things. So what Wilson, the war starts for Wilson, and how does he behave? Remember, he wants power, but he's partly this blunt kind of Presbyterian. And that's important also, that he's from this Presbyterian background. And I work at a Presbyterian college. I've worked for Presbyterians all my life. And again, many of my best friends are Presbyterians. One thing that you know, if you too are a Presbyterian, is that Presbyterians do a lot of handling of abstract words, but in a very pragmatic way. So grace, faith, these kinds of words, they have a very specific meaning of the of those words and deal with them all the time. And Wilson also, he's writing the not the charter of the league, he's writing the covenant of the league, right? He's going to get all of his experts on the boat and say to them on the way to the Versailles, way to the Paris Peace Conference, tell me what is right, and I will fight for it. And so he's this very, although he's probably far from his Presbyterianism, he's raised up in this mode, and I think there's a lot going on there. I think he wants power, and I think he wants America to be an extension of his power, and I think he wants to extend America and rewrite the whole system. But he doesn't know it all that yet. I mean, it hasn't come to him all yet. And partly he gets pushed there by a house. That's what I'm thinking based on these psychological studies and newer information and so forth. Anyway, the war starts, of course. It, August 4th is the day that the British declare war. Wilson, on August 19th, 1914, stood before Congress and said, every man who truly loves America will speak and will act and speak in the true spirit of neutrality. We'll all be neutral, totally neutral, only neutrality here. When the British saw a loan, Wilson vetoed it. They wanted to float a public bond loan. And then these international bankers came to him and said, "Yeah, and we'll back it." And you know, and Wilson said no. Actually, William Jennings Bryan said no. You remember Wilson as his Secretary of State? Well, he disliked most of the people in his cabinet, to tell you the truth. He got as a Secretary of State William Jennings Bryan, who had run for the presidency twice, who is one of the most famous orators in America, was not in the progressive movement, but rather the populist movement, and was the man of the people, and so forth and so on. And As Secretary of State, he blocked those loans to begin with, and Wilson went along with that. Even though it's becoming more and more apparent that it's got to be becoming apparent to Wilson at this point that he is actually a tool and a kind of extension of the J.P. Morgan interest. But of course, Morgan and House are selling those interests to him as a wise thing. I mean, we're not out for money. We're not out for power. We got the power. We got the money. What we want is the good of the world, don't you see? And you too want the good of the world. We all want the same thing. So that's where we're going. When the Lusitania was sunk, we'll talk about it in a second, but Cunard liner with Americans, a bunch of Americans on it, and that was in 1915. And when the Lusitania was sunk, then Woodrow Wilson is, so far he's been kind of neutral, but he takes very strong language and says those who are responsible will pay for this, et cetera, et cetera. And Ryan said you just can't say that if you're a statesman, and so he resigned. Was replaced by Robert Lansing, who had his own problems and frictions with Wilson. Well, most of the people who knew Wilson had frictions with him, even Colonel House eventually. In September 1915, Morgan and a group of bankers were permitted to underwrite then the bond issue that the British had wanted before. This was $500 million in 1915 dollars. There's a little formula there going, but the actual rate of interest is about 7%. So that's a tidy sum, actually. J.P. Morgan himself was then named purchasing agent for the Entente powers in the United States. And, of course, what he's doing is using these loan monies to buy stuff for the war here in the United States. Eventually, the loans to the Entente powers would amount to about $2.6 billion in 1915, 16, 17, 18 dollars. And all of this went to buy munitions, food, et cetera, et cetera. And one of those et ceteras was that a substantial portion of this money was then just passed along as cash subventions to American newspapers and American journals so that British representatives would say, well, look, you know, we'll give you your $5,000 for this month, and we need these three articles. Just put them anywhere you like as long as it's the front page. And so they would put in articles that were pro-British, anti-German, that published when the Bryce Report came along. It was sure to be on the front page in all the papers, at least that the British were paying for. And so this is a very, very important aspect of all this. This is something that's front and center in the great book Merchants of Death, in the foreword and in the book itself. That the press issue here was extremely crucial to get the United States into the war. So we have a very neutral there. Meanwhile, no loans for the Germans, and German officials who were over here seeking out loans, remember, we're neutral, were harassed, they were vilified. I give you the case of a briefcase Albert, Heinrich Albert. He was a very, very, I really like him. He was in part of my research 25 years ago on the Upper Silesia plebiscite, and I just read memo after memo, and I kind of liked him, you know. There I was 60 or 70 years later, and I just liked his style. I read some things about him by his colleagues, and they said, oh, the guy was so American. He loved America. He was actually the minister. He was the chief secretary, the chief permanent official in the Ministry of the Interior. And in fact, before the war, had been in America at the St. Louis Fair as an Interior Ministry official. And indeed, they sent him over on a mission once the war started, a mission to America to talk to people, talk to bankers about loans. But everywhere he went, he found that he was that the some mysterious British guys or mysterious American policemen had gotten there first and told people not to receive it. So he began to investigate, and he found out that his communications were tapped, his mail was being read. Eventually, his briefcase was stolen while he dozed off on a streetcar. He conceived in the meanwhile of a kind of funny idea. I mean, he couldn't get loans, and he knew that all these loans were going for munitions for the British. This is 1915. And so he does what he can, and it's little things, but he had this great idea. It turns out that the British made most of the phenols, in the world, and phenol is an ingredient, oddly, to both bombs and aspirin. And so Heinrich Albert got the idea. He said, "Well, I can't. They won't let me borrow money, and they won't make bombs for us. But what I can do is set up a company here in America and buy all the phenol I can get my hands on, and then put it in a little plant, and we'll connect ourselves with Bayer, the chemical company and pharmaceutical company in Germany, and we'll produce aspirin with the phenol." So I mean, it was a brilliant thing. In other words, you're making aspirin instead of bombs. I mean, who can beat that? I mean, this is one of the great strokes of genius I think that I've ever heard. But Albert today is vilified. He is still vilified, of course, even in terms of the 1915-16 propaganda. Look on Wikipedia after we finish. Not now. Stay with me. I'm kidding. You can look now. But it's at the great phenol plot. Well, they tell what I just told, except he's cast, it's inaccurate. They say he was an attorney who was here as a spy and all that. But their proof that he was a spy is that he bought this company. Well, that was totally legal. And at the end of their article, they say, well, he was never charged with anything. Well, of course he wasn't charged with anything. There was nothing to charge him with. But the whole thing was eventually broken up. The newspapers splashed this on the front page of every newspaper, every British paid newspaper, as the great phenol plot, as if it's some horrific thing. And the British were making munitions the whole time with the money that they had borrowed from the American citizens. So he was no spy master. He was no plot master. He was a ministry of the interior official who was trying to arrange for some loans and so forth. And a funny guy. He told the story to one of his colleagues. One of his colleagues wrote a very fine memoir that's one of my favorites. He told his colleague this story that he happened to be in Washington during the Truman administration and met Bess Truman, and they introduced. They said, "This is Heinrich Albert," and she said, "Oh, you must be Briefcase Albert." So that's why I throw that briefcase in there. Yes, headaches to U.S. bankers. Well done, sir. Well done, Malcolm. I like it. You get a check plus for the evening. All right. So, anyway, this just looks like it's kind of unfinished. You know, one thing. Here's the Nye report. There was in the run up to World War II, some of the isolationists in the Senate got together and put together a commission to study munitions and all these different things in parts of the neutrality or non-neutrality in the war. And the Nye Commission dealt with these things. And here's a great quotation about that. Nye reiterated in the Senate, on top of his report, that no member of the Munitions Committee, this quotation, has ever contended that it was munitions makers that took us to war, but that the committee and its members have said again and again that it was war trade and the war boom that played a primary part in moving the United States to war. This is so important. There's also this. There were all kinds of people. I'm about to talk about the blockade and submarines, and then we'll get to the war. But let me say this, because I don't think I have a slide for this. And that is the war as fulfillment. That Rothbard, the famous Rothbard essay, can't be read too much. So many people in all countries on all sides look to the war to fulfill needs that they had, desires that they had, goals that they had. The Irish were about to go at each other. The Northern Irish and the Southern Irish before the war. The war started, and they both turned their fighting groups into divisions because they said, "We'll get farther that way. We'll get fulfillment that way." American blacks, many of the elite said, "This is going to be great if we can just get in the war and prove that we are true blue Americans. We'll show them that we can be as good of patriots as anybody else." Rothbard deals mainly with intellectuals, but it goes into so many groups. There are all these tendencies and trends that were already entrained, and so many people see that as a fulfillment of some kind. It's a very, very important aspect to the background of Wilson, who's been being herded and pushed and drawing himself toward a kind of power. And one of, the, of course, the greatest desire of power is then to be the arbitrator of the war. So he offers himself as peacemaker at numerous different points, and eventually offers his League of Nations as a way of peacemaking, so that he's introduced a way to run the world in the future. Most important. Okay, well, let me talk about the issue of the submarines, because this kind of brings us into the war. I want to mention first that the British blockade, I've already talked about it, but I reiterate that the British announced it in August 1914. They made therefore the whole ocean a war zone around Germany's coasts. Nobody could go in and out. And contraband was then defined. Food was put on the list of contraband items, which was totally illegal. All scholars agree now it was against international law, international custom, the Hague and Geneva agreements, etc. Well, Woodrow Wilson, beginning in 1916, declared that the blockade was totally legal. And I should add here that eventually, I mean, the Germans said it was starving them out, but eventually, scholarly opinion today goes from, well, there's a little lower estimates out there, but 400,000 to 750,000 as a direct result of this blockade. So the Germans responded with unrestricted submarine warfare. By this we mean restricted submarine warfare is a sub doesn't get to use what it does best. A sub has to come to the surface of the water, hail a ship. It can attack a military ship. That's okay. And somebody asked last week, and they certainly did. And they attacked, and sometimes they got killed, and sometimes they did the killing. But they can attack a military ship. But if it's a merchant ship, they have to surface to say, who are you, do you have contraband, et cetera, are you carrying arms or whatever? And that's restricted submarine warfare. But in that case, many commanders of the merchant vessels would just ram the submarine. The submarine had no defenses, so it would be sunk. So as one of the ways of breaking up the stalemate we talked about in the second or third class, the Germans decided to make this announcement. All the waters surrounding Great Britain, you can read that there. That's from February 4th, 1915. And so they're declaring unrestricted submarine warfare. And they're going to sink merchant ships, and they sink numerous ones. And there's some Americans on those ships, a few here and a few there. And after American protest, then they call off this first unrestricted sub campaign. But There's another, somewhat more limited, unrestricted campaign in 1916, and again a Wilson protest, and again they call this off. But under the influence of Hindenburg and Ludendorff, really, really lobbying for this, for it, they know how bad it is on the front. They know that there has to be some relief, that there has to be an end of the blockade, and so forth and so on. So they persuade the Kaiser to go in with them, and they declare fully unrestricted submarine warfare in January 1917. And then the Lusitania comes back into the discussion, the German subs are sinking also other ships with Americans on them, and some American ships that are carrying war material to the continent. So the Germans declare all of this zone that you see on this map to be a war zone. Some ships that were liners, and this was totally in contravention of international law, some ships carried munitions and passengers. So the passengers were basically human shields to the ammunition. And one such ship, the Lusitania, I mean, there were many, many of these, and many were sunk. And the Lusitania was one that did have munitions on board. It was carrying them. And the German embassy put notice in 15 or 16 newspapers in the New York area, as you see here, just telling people you can't go on this ship if you want to be safe because it's carrying weapons, and it certainly was. So that's the Lusitania, and you see the uses to which the Lusitania was put almost immediately. It has some other effects we'll talk about later. I want to mention here that if you want a really fine detailed read on all of this blow by blow, there's so much more here. There's so many incidents. There's so many stages. Try Justice Dunicke and his new book, Nothing Less Than War, A New History of America's Entry into World War I. It's from last year. He's a revisionist historian. He's a brilliant historian, one of the great historians of our generation. And so I throw that in at this point so you'll know it. You know, in the midst of all this, House is in Europe. Woodrow Wilson sent him as his personal emissary to deal with all the Europeans and to keep Wilson apprised of what America should do. And so House is pushing from Europe. He's talking with all the prime ministers and all the bankers and all the influential people, and living a life at the full level of any political manipulator. And so he goes to Edward Gray on the 22nd of February 1916 and says, Colonel, in Gray's memo of this meeting, and they both sign it, Colonel House told me that President Wilson was ready on hearing from France and England that the moment was opportune to propose that a conference should be summoned to put an end to the war. Should the Allies accept this proposal and should Germany refuse it, then the United States would probably enter the war. So House is now threatening that there would be American entry as early as February 1916. Then the unlimited submarine warfare comes up. The case of the Lusitania in particular. We can talk more about those details if you want to in a minute. Just before war is declared, there is this ridiculous Zimmerman telegram. It probably about the stupidest thing that's ever been done in political annals. Dunica does not think that this Zimmerman note is as important to the outbreak of the war. He thinks it was going that way anyway, and the Zimmerman note is just another kind of irritant that helped whip up enthusiasm along with all the rest, the Bryce report and all these pathetic reports of Lusitania victims that had been gone over in 1915 that were brought back now in 1917. But the telegram is this ridiculous offer on the part of Germany to link together with Mexico and then give them part of Texas and Arizona in return. Well, you know, it was pretty ridiculous. And it was intercepted by the British, and then it was given to Wilson, and he gave it to the newspapers. So that's the Zimmerman note. The British didn't pass this along until February 24th. It hit the papers on March 1st, and then a war is declared on April 6th, 1917. I want to end tonight with the words of William Jennings Bryan, who, and her kind of prophetic words, I think. It's not likely, he said, that either side will win so complete a victory as to be able to dictate terms. And if either side does win such a victory, it will probably mean preparation for another war. It would seem better to look for a more rational basis for peace. So, yes, indeed, I think that's absolutely correct. So that's the lecture for this evening, and let the fun begin. And I will now pore over the earlier comments for questions, and I'll see if I can answer those as you're thinking up new ones. Let's see. No questions. Let's see. Rice was British. Yes, he was British. And Tom Miller mentions that, and that also mentioned that. Let's see. Is there any way you're able to post that Wilson article from 79? Yes, I will. Let me jot that down, unless it's already been done, but I'll jot that down, post the... Then there was a little bit on the Nye Committee. Yes, very interesting. Another great moment in American history when the investigation came to an abrupt end, funds were cut off, etc. Okay. So now we're to the new questions, and I will open up the question and answers. Oh, there's someone there. Okay. Let me, since I was on Laura's, I'll answer the... that first, and then jump down to the Q&As with Nathan and Malcolm, etc. With all these loans going back and forth between the Entente powers, I cannot see them being paid back in full. At the end of the war, were these loans forgiven? No, they weren't, Laura. Not yet. They were. This was all part of the reparations deal. I'm going to outline this a little bit later in some detail with a chart and everything, but essentially after the war, Germany was a wreck, and the Calvin Coolidge's vice president came to Germany and arranged for a deal whereby Morgan and his folks would loan Germany money to pay reparations. Then Germany was supposed to pay reparations to England and France, and they were supposed to pay money back to the United States, all right? And so the money just circulated around, and that was what went on for several years. It got rewritten by a partner in J.P. Morgan and Company named Owen Young in 1928, and then each time they extended German, they lowered the total reparations payments a little, and they extended the payments, et cetera. And again, I'll go over this again, but it's because it's really important. But in the end, once the Depression hit, Hoover proposed a moratorium on reparation payments. And then when the British and French said, oh, and on war loan payments too, Hoover said, well, no, not on war loan payments, just on reparation payments. So there was this funny moment there. But actually those loans then were forgiven once Roosevelt got in. So they were forgiven later, and so... The bankers, as usual, made out like bandits because they had been charging the fees. They'd gotten their money back and more on top. Okay, let's see. So I'm going to jump down to the Q&A questions now. Was there any element of classical liberalism during the revolution of 1917, or were there only different socialist factions and monarchists? No, I think that there were. I think there was quite a strong element of classical liberalism. I don't think in that all Russian overwhelming autocracy that there were many people who would have thought, well, you know, tiny little limited government maybe. But on the other hand, anarchism comes from Russia, so a lot of the anarchists were thinking that way. But they were almost all left anarchists and were thinking about sort of shared collectivism on the bottom of the society rather than a kind of a free market society. But as far as the parties that counted, the Cadet Party had, it seems like a good party. I can't think of their platform right off the bat, but I mean they wanted open government and so forth. I think I could probably vote for them if we voted. So anyway, yeah, there was an element of that, right? It's at some point in there, but there were a lot of conservative, neocon type liberals and whatnot, and socialists. Malcolm asked, to what extent did worker movements in one country foment revolution in other countries or help incentivize their own country to fight another so that revolution would foment the country attack? Well, Lenin declared the existence of the Communist International or the Comintern, and that was to be, I mean, Lenin was the prophet of world revolution. And so what he wanted to happen, what Trotsky wanted to happen, and Zinoviev and the whole group, was to bring Europe and then the world into this huge world revolution. And so, yes, they sent Karl Radek, who was on the Council of People's Commissars, to Germany because they said, man, there's something going on here. There's a lot of strikes. It's 1917, 1918. We'll just get them worked up, and there eventually was a revolution in Germany in November 1918, not totally communist, but it was certainly participated in by the communists. So, yeah, in other places, I mean, Bela Kun was part of the Bolshevik Revolution and went back to his native Hungary and took over in Hungary, and that was put down by an Allied army in the wake of the war. So, yeah, that certainly did happen. It's not far-fetched at all. It really did happen. Malcolm also says, to what extent do you think that Alexander Parvus and German intelligence helped foment revolution in Russia? Oh, I think that that Alexander Helfand, who's, as you say, his name was his revolutionary nom de guerre was Parvus, P-A-R-V-U-S. He was very much the broker of the whole deal for the German Foreign Office and the German General Staff to get Lenin back to Russia from Zurich. So he's the guy. He was a colleague of Lenin's. He was a Bolshevik, and he was an arms merchant. So yeah, there's important books on that, and maybe I should jot those down too in a kind of continuing documentation of the course. But yeah, that's a good thing to bring up. I didn't have time to go through the whole plot. There's a lot more to it also. Malcolm says, on our reading mentioned the economical conference in Paris. Can you please give me your take on what it was and the consequences thereof? I don't recall which economical conference is referenced there, Malcolm, so if you could specify that, I will. I don't even know what year you're talking about. Malcolm says, would you compare the homogenization of ethnic groups in pre-World War I with what is going on in Afghanistan now? I'm not sure if you mean in the United States and kind of the... I don't see the parallel. I'm sorry. I just don't. I'm sort of stuck here in the midst of World War I, and so I think I'll stay there. Edmund Brooks, any resources you'd recommend for the blockade by the British? Yes, absolutely. There's a book by Paul C. Vincent, and it's an excellent book. All it's devoted to the blockade. I think it's called The Hunger Blockade, if that's the title or not, it's Paul C. Vincent. He's a very good guy, a very thorough scholar, a good historian, and he tells that his is the very best book on it. Edmund Brooks, is there any validity to the argument that Zionists in Britain and the U.S. played a role in bringing the U.S. into World War I in exchange for the mandate of Palestine? Edmund, the answer is I don't know. My sense of it, having done the reading, and my sense of it knowing about the generation of the Balfour Declaration and all of it, and the way that the United States and Britain related, I don't think that's at the core of anything in particular. I think there's bigger game afoot. I think the purposes of, for example, the bankers were global, and it's certainly true that many of, for example, Jacob Schiff was very much committed to the cause of the poor Jews in Russia, and I think very much wanted to see the Tsarist regime tumble down, and was willing to help with that. So there may have been money given. Certainly New York rich people were giving money to Zionism all along the way. But I don't see that as bringing the United States into the war. I think these other issues were more important. But as I say, everybody was seeing this as fulfillment. I mean, this is just another area, and I don't think it was just the intellectuals, and I don't think it was just the bankers or the minorities or whatever, but this is certainly another group like that. That's more people who want a kind of fulfillment. Again, the last one on the question answer is, have you heard of the Greens during the Russian Revolution? If so, how were they different from the typical Bolsheviks? Well, the Greens were not Bolsheviks at all. The Greens were a mix of peasant anarchists, of local armies, of people who just put together militias to protect their homes and their property. I'm sure they did some bad things because that civil war escalated so violently and the communists were so horrifically brutal in their domination of a place. And the whites were brutal too in return. I mean, it got to be a war of savage butchery in the very opening stages. So I don't doubt that the Greens did some bad things too, but they're the guys I would root for. There's a good book on that by Oliver Radke, used to teach at the University of Texas, not to be confused with my own Austin College, but nonetheless a good school. And Radke, R-A-D-K-Y, and that's a good source on that. Let me go back up to the chat line and then follow those questions down. These are great questions you're asking. Man, you're on fire tonight. Let's see. Malcolm says, hey, Malcolm, how'd you get back up here? I thought you were down on the question and answer line. In our reading on the wiki Wikipedia about the Russian Revolution, it mentions a revisionist historian, Lynch, who focuses on the role of the people. Rasputin was a fatal disease to the Tsarist regime. What do you know of this historian and his beliefs on the role of people in history? That's all I know, Malcolm, just what I read there. I hadn't heard of him before I read that Wikipedia article. Let's see. There's no link or reference, you know, Lynch's first name. No, I don't. Laura asks, you stated that at the time of the February Revolution, the other Entente powers were afraid of what would happen if Russia pulled out of the war. That same feeling of dread doesn't seem to appear when Russia finally did pull out after the Bolshevik Revolution. Was this change of feelings due entirely to the war situation, entry of the U.S., or was there also something else involved? That's a great question, and they should have felt more shocked than they did. But it's certainly true that they thought with the Americans on their side, even if the Russians drop out, we've got this now. Remember, the Americans were basically as productive as you know many of these powers put together. And so, if you had to swap somebody, if you're the Entente, you had to say, okay, well, we have to give up one to get one. This is a great trade because you're taking the poor, you're taking away the poorest of your allies, and you're adding the richest one in the world. So, I think that's it. But there, we're going to see it's not without an impact. I mean, there were a lot of deaths. Because of it, because the Germans did bring from the front all these Germans to the Western Front. They did carry out an absolutely smashing, well-planned, well-timed attack in the spring of 1918. We're going to talk a lot about that. And the Austrians did redouble their efforts in Italy. So there was a huge impact because of this, but and in many other directions too. But I think that's what they were thinking. And so I think they should have been more worried than they were, but I think they were so relieved that the Americans did. That's the goose that laid the golden egg. That was what they were all looking for. It's a great question. In Germany in 1995, pay off the last installment of interest finally settling. That's exactly right. That's exactly right. I've got the article in my files. I saw it the other day. It was only a moratorium that Hoover called for. So we never canceled that. They kept on paying on through the ages. And another funny thing is that in the treaty itself, in the Versailles Treaty, in the financial clauses, about half of them are devoted to how many hogs and how much coal and how many sticks of timber will be used. To pay in what measure for what. So it's kind of funny. I don't think they paid off not in 1995 with any hogs, but that would be nice if they had. Okay, let's see. Link on par was very good. The Paris Economic Conference. Malcolm, I will try to get to that and look at the forum, Paris Economic Conference. But I don't trust myself enough to navigate away from this page. I'm just going to stick right here because I hate for it to blip out and we have to try to get back on. I'm afraid that one might cut all this pretty short. So let's see. Cam gives the name of Paul Vincent's book. And blockade, more about that. Okay. Louis Maynard says, can you state the differences between the Soviet Party and the Bolsheviks? I can't seem to understand the difference between the two. Yes, Louis, that's a very good question, and I wasn't as clear. I was kind of racing through that. There were many different kinds of sort of socialists and anarchists that bubbled up in Russia after the great reforms of the 1860s by Alexander II, and that's the homeland of anarchism. That's Bakunin. That's all the violence guys. All these groups hyper anarchist groups who decided to bring down the old regime by means of assassination and killing. A million little groups called Death in Our Homeland, Death in Our Motherland, Death to the whatever. And so there were all kinds of people. There was a large movement in Kuwait at first called the Social Revolutionary Movement eventually. And these social revolutionaries were all types who wanted a new socialist Russia without the king. Or maybe some of them even would allow the king to stay, but only roughly at the top. And these SRs, social revolutionaries, wanted a situation in which there was basically a society organized on something like the principles of the Russian village, or Mir, which is the Russian word for, remember the spaceship called Mir? That means village. So a lot of people in the wake of the 60s and 70s, young people in these movements would go out to peasant villages. I mean, they're all urban, you know, university students. And they go out and sit there and watch. In fact, there is such a character in Fiddler on the Roof, if you've ever seen the musical. There's one of the main characters is a city guy who comes out to, you know, sort of go to the country, as they said, go to the peasants. And so there's this feeling in Russia on the left that there's this kind of Russianist group. And by the way, this group was all Russian oriented, didn't let Jews in. I mean, they didn't, you know, it's very much a kind of Russian soil kind of anarchism. Anyway, an offshoot of this group, or an analog to the group at the same time, it's a little bit of an offshoot, was this group that advocated a way of doing this, not just go to the village and imitate the village, but really to figure out a way to make all this work. And that would be by creating councils in every village, councils in every factory, councils here and there, in every precinct of the city, in your business, there's a council. So the revolution comes, and it's all Soviets, that's all councils. And so what they would do, these councils would say, people in the factory would say, well, what we need to do is widen the road out here. And then they'd send their representatives to the regional council, and their representatives would say, we got to widen the road down where we live. And then people would back that around, and then it would go up to the Supreme Council somewhere. And so this was the idea. And this also, it wasn't just the Bolshevik movement, but the council movement also got transferred to Germany. Actually, the German Revolution of 1918 is going to be much more a council-oriented movement than even it was in Russia. But there are councils everywhere that suddenly spring up in the after the February Revolution, as we call it, the first one. There were councils everywhere. This was a going concern, and within the city of St. Petersburg, there were actually, you know, it was kind of beginning to take on the functions of a government and kind of running like that. So Lenin had to attach himself to that movement, though. This council movement was not really Marxist in any true sense. They didn't read Marx. He was not their Bible. It was a different kind of socialism. But Lenin had to say that because he wanted to co-opt that movement, and he did. And then later killed a bunch of them. I hope that answers your question, Louis. If it doesn't, just let me know. If we have longer questions or questions that require a site, should we post them? Yeah, the forum is a great thing, and not many people are posting any. I don't think there's been any discussion on the forum, but yeah, that's what I would prefer, because I really just can't navigate anywhere. And to tell you the truth, I mean, there's no lecturer in the world who you can just ask any question and every detail of every question and expect them to know it, because, you know, that's just not the way anybody is. I mean, I think I know a lot, but I don't know everything. And so, yeah, that would take some thought. Yeah, Malcolm says he thinks they just stopped paying, but there was a big hoopla in the paper that they had finally finished off. But it had been the final sum had been negotiated way down in the meanwhile, so it wasn't the original amount. And indeed, there was no original amount in the treaty, as we'll see. That was all worked out in about three different economic conferences after World War I, and it was announced in May 1921 that what the deal was. Let's see. So Leslie says, Wilson ran as a peace candidate in 1916, and the U.S. entered the war soon after his reelection. Yeah, I forgot to mention the election. He kept us out of war, but I think you all know that. Did Wilson intend to enter the war after the election no matter what the Germans did. Well, I think that's a $64 question. Leslie, I don't know. If you read some of the things he was saying, if you read what House was saying, if you read the analyses of the big, his most important biographers, Arthur Link, they'll say something different. This is a big question. I mean, in his heart of hearts, I think he wanted to. I mean, the game plan was to be in a lofty position, and whether getting in the war was going to do it. I kind of think he was intending to go to war. So it's hard to say. I mean, your question is basically, was he just standing there lying to people day in and day out when he, allowed this slogan, he kept us out of war, to be held up on placards all around as he campaigned? And that I don't know. I mean, he actually had kept the country out of war at that point, so I guess he could say to himself, well, even if I go to war in 2 months, then I did keep us out of war. So I don't know. It's a good question. I mean, these things, who knows what's in somebody's hearts. It's pretty hard to say, but it seems like he seems like he was moving that way. But on the other hand, there could have been anything. He had offered three or four times to be the big peacemaker and to step in as arbitrator. And so, if he could see that happening too, then, he wouldn't have to go to war to be the big shot. But instead, the Russian Revolution, the first one, happened. And so that changed things quite a bit. Let's see. Am I wrong to see the council movement in the communist civilization as the lobbying movement in the democratic civilization? Well, maybe so. Maybe it's, but it also it takes the form of a government. You see, I mean, it's supposed to be nothing else. The government's supposed to wither away. And there just be these councils. So anything you want starts not at the top of the system, at the pinnacle, but it starts at the broad base of it, and all these people are bringing their desires upwards. So yeah, I guess it's like lobbying, but it's lobbying from the mass of the people, and it moves on up to the top of the pyramid. Let's see. Malcolm says, later in the course, are you going to cover why Wilson went to direct election of senators versus the way it was done before the state legislatures voted for that state? I doubt that we'll have time to cover that. I don't see it as an integral part of the war. Of course, it's an integral part of American history, but I don't see it as a part of this. But if somebody wants me to talk about that a little bit, I'll be glad to. Let's see. Edmund Brooks asks, what were Mensheviks and how are they different from Bolsheviks? Another good question. So in 1890, I think it's 94, the Socialist Party of Russia was founded. Social Democratic Party of Russia, all right? Social Democratic Party of Russia. And that's the first officially Marxist party. It's an analog to the SPD in Germany, the Social Democratic Party of Germany, and the Communist Party in France. The Socialist Party in France, the biggest one at that time. And so these socialist parties were interconnected. They were Marxist parties, okay? But it was also a time, the 1890s, of revisionism within the German Socialist Party and to some extent within all European parties. So revisionism was this. A lot of socialists in Germany, it was led by a man named Eduard Bernstein, said, okay, here's what we need to do. we need to drop the sort of stricter, more revolutionary parts of Marx and just ease into socialism and cooperate with the system, all right? So that's what the German SPD did, except for its wild, radical, revolutionary fringe. But in other countries, at exactly the same time, the Fabian movement in Britain, for example, tried to usher in a kind of socialism that would cooperate with the system and eventually achieve socialism, all right? So the Russian party was founded at this odd moment, just before all these changes were happening in Europe. And so as it was formed, and it was totally illegal, totally underground, basically it had both kinds in it. It had both socialists who wanted to cooperate with some future constitutional system and then gradually socialize it, and it had people who wanted revolution, just like Marx said. So what happened was that these two factions went at each other, and in 1903, the editor of the main Socialist Party of Russia newspaper, Lenin, led a split in the party, and some few of his revolutionary guys went off with him and they split the party. But for propaganda purposes, they called themselves the majority, the majorityists, and that's what Bolshevik means. And they labeled the other guys, most of the party that they withdrew from, they labeled those guys as minorityists or Mensheviks. So the Mensheviks were the more moderate socialist people in the Russian party whom Lenin and his crew and his old Bolsheviks withdrew from. And I hope that makes sense. It's a complicated story for such little impact, but that's the story there, Edmund. Okay, let's go back up here and let's see. Yeah, I don't see any more questions. It's also 9:02, so I guess we're all running out of steam, and we've already had a couple people drop out. So I say we call it a night. Yes, thank you, Cam. I was about to ask for that. And I still have some cold coffee left, so I'll raise a cup. Very good. Good night to everybody. Thanks for being along. I enjoyed it. I hope you got something out of it. And thank you, Laura. Thank you, Erica. Thank you. Yeah, Malcolm, it's not very good. I like your joke, though. Excellent joke. I like that headache joke. Savannah, good night. Thank you. And Edmund, very good. And thanks, many thanks again to Kim and his work on here. Louis, thank you. Thanks for the good questions, everybody. I will see you next week.